was looking at the subject of on your handouts. I think it says, "Are you getting enough?" And what I'm referring to there is sleep. I want to talk a little bit about that, but wrap it up in a different subject, or at least explore it as part of something else. I think what we'll do is I'll teach for a while. I'll try and finish with enough time to then see if any of you have got any words of knowledge or prophecy and stuff, and we can minister to each other a bit at the end. We're going to look at 2 Corinthians chapter 4, in particular two verses in that. And if you haven't got a Bible, there are a few scattered around. Grab one and see if you can find your way to the second book of Corinthians, chapter 4. It could be that what I say and talk about is bores you, or I just don't entertain you, in which case you could usefully use the next half an hour just reading through that passage anyway, and it'll look as though you're listening and look very spiritual. It's always been an ambition of mine to do what they say. You know, they talk about, are you going to finish well? They talk about finishing well, projects and things like that, but also your life. Are you going to finish well? Are you going to run through the end, the line at the end at full pelt, you know? And that's always been an ambition of mine. But I went to a seminar recently, a conference with some of the other guys here, and run by a chap called Arch Hart, and who's an expert. He's a professor of psychobabble and things. And he was explaining that he opened my eyes to a different way of looking at this. He said, you can only finish well if you run well. Of course, that makes sense. You can't sprint through the end unless you've run at a good pace all the way through the race. And any athlete knows that. I used to play rugby down at Headingley in my youth a long time ago. And there was a guy there who I played with, who we'll call him Pete, who was a brilliant, brilliant rugby player, a great flanker, and would have easily played for England, except he didn't look after himself. And so we used to get him in our team. I played around about third, so it wasn't very good. It was mainly the beer. I had a nice sidestep on a good day. And Pete, we'd get him to play for us, but we'd only ever assume, if he was in the team, we'd always have another substitute, because we knew that he'd play flat out for 30 minutes, 45 minutes. Then at halftime, he'd have to go off and recover and throw his guts out somewhere. Or we'd bring him on at halftime as our special sub and try and figure that somebody got injured. Because he couldn't finish the game. He was a brilliant player, but he couldn't finish the game. He could only play about half of the game. And this has got me thinking, because when I made my first decision to follow Jesus, first of several, just to make sure, when I was about 9, and I was at a boarding school in the Himalayas, and we had a little devotional time. It was a Christian missionary boarding school, and there was this thing about, if you don't become a Christian, decide to follow Jesus, you're going to go to hell, not heaven. And that didn't sound appealing, and so I thought, well, I'd rather go to heaven. And so I made a decision then, and at a deep level, it sorted out that issue for me. And I've never really worried about when I die or anything like that. I'm perfectly happy that I'm going to a great place, can't wait to meet God and get rid of my mortgage, apart from anything else. And I know there's more to it than that, and I've learned that over the years. But I was only 9, and it seemed like a good idea at the time. But what it's led to has been a subconscious living my life at a pace which isn't designed to hit 70. It's just getting as much done as fast as I possibly can, because I don't really care when I go, sort of thing. And this guy, Arch Hart, was challenging me. He said, you have no right not to live your full 70. He said, God doesn't need you in heaven any earlier. What are you doing trying to get there sooner than that? And so I had to get me thinking, and I picked up this card in the shop the other day. It says, if I'd known I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of myself. I've been reminded that the likelihood is most of us will get to our 70. That's the way it tends to work out statistically. Sometimes God takes us before then, fine, but most of us need to assume that this is going to be what happens. And to finish before then is to finish early, and that's not usually part of the plan. So to live my life in a way that will cut short that is sinful. I'm being disobedient. I'm not looking after what he's given me to look after. I need to run full pelt, run well, not full pelt all the way. It's a marathon, not a sprint. So what does that mean? Let's look at 2 Corinthians 4. I was hoping to spend quite a lot of time on this, but what we'll do is we'll just look at two verses in particular. Let me read to you from verse 7 in 2 Corinthians 4. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power, he's been talking about the power of God in our lives in the verses before that, this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. We are hard-pressed on every side but not crushed, perplexed but not in despair, persecuted but not abandoned, struck down but not destroyed. We always carry around in our body the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. For we who are alive are always being given over to death for Jesus' sake, so that his life may be revealed in our mortal body. So then, death is at work in us, but life is at work in you. Skip to verse 16. Therefore, we do not lose heart. Though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed day by day. For our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them all. So we fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary. What is unseen is temporal. It's quite a complicated passage there, and I don't propose to go into some of those bits in this time around in detail. I think we'll probably come back to it in the future. But I want to pick up on a particular theme that emerges on a couple of themes. Before we do that, let's just... I want to talk about stress. It's one of the major challenges we face in our culture and our time is stress. Now, when Paul wrote this, yes, he had some points of stress, but it was different from what we have. He had points of crisis, like being shipwrecked, which most of us won't have, which is definitely an occasion for stress, and getting beaten up and things like that. It's different today. The reason it's different is because our culture runs at a much, much faster pace than his culture did, and our culture doesn't stop when the sun goes down. It carries on 24/7. So we are doing much more in our time than Paul would have been doing, and we don't give ourselves the time to recover that he would have had. It's a very simple formula. Most of us live in this culture and buy into it, hook, line, and sinker. Some of us are fighting against it. I'm really talking to those of you who, like me, are dragged into this culture of pace and activity and what leads to stress. Stress is non-stop, and there's little recovery time. Let me give you an example. Let me walk you through a day where sometimes I end up like this. Wake up in the morning to the deeply unpleasant sound of an alarm. All alarm clocks are deeply unpleasant. And then I put on the radio, or you put on the TV, and you get worried by a news report about a child abduction or rising mortgage rates. The household goes through 60 minutes of anguish as sleepers are chased out of bed, clothes are dragged out of the washing and iron, keys are lost, buses missed. No time for preparing the day with a leisurely breakfast and time to pray together. On the contrary, inject some caffeine into the system and get running. Sit in a traffic jam, building annoyance with every red light and every idiot driver. Drive or ride and text and phone and listen to the iPod all at the same time, but forget to process your thoughts on the day before and planning for this one. Rush into work without time to compose yourself. Stray into a confrontation with a class of 30 kids or a difficult patient or a client with a complaint. Turn on the computer and spend 10 minutes deleting spam, then get faced with a million email messages, prioritizing your day and tyrannizing your timetable. The World Wide Web speeds everything up, so everyone expects an answer seconds after they've hit send. Keep up the caffeine fixes. Grab a sandwich whilst on your feet. The computer blinks and beeps at you all day with messages and pop-ups and sounds which mean not sure what. The mobile phone shouts and squeals with messages and calls, and that's everybody else's, never mind yours. You get home to more calls and people wanting meals or help with your homework or needing to make your own dinner or preparing for a meeting or balancing your finances. Even without a meeting, you decide to watch the football and end up screaming at the TV. Or watch Big Brother or EastEnders or the news and work yourself into a lather about man's unpleasantness to man. You check your email, MSN, Skype, MySpace, Facebook, Twitter. Oh, and you open the post. Is there a bill to pay or an overdue one to worry about? Have a row with somebody on the phone or your kid and try to get to sleep with a dozen worries circling around your brain. I feel stressed just thinking about life. Even assuming you get a good night's sleep, when are you not stressed? When is your body recovering? When Paul's day, when the sun went down, they chilled out and went to bed. The various reactions in our body, when stress happens to us, our biochemical reactions and psychological reactions are designed by God to cope with stress in a really good way. We're built to be able to deal with it for a while. And then we're built to be able to recover afterwards. The way we live, the stress turns against us. And it says, I've tried to help you go through this. You're not listening. Off to hospital. So the result will be something like increase in pain or increase in anxiety or an increased risk of illness or an increased fatigue or depression. Now, I wouldn't be surprised if one of those ticks a box for you or more than one. You may be glad to realize it's not just you then. The pace of life has increased, which brings about stress and allows for less restoration time, which means no time to recover. The point is, I don't just feel stressed a lot. My body is giving up trying to help me cope with it. It's telling me to slow down, rest, look after myself, do less, and it's just going to put me in hospital. Isn't it interesting that just as I get onto the subject, and God's been speaking to me about this for about 6 months or so, and then I go on this conference, and then I line up to speak on it today, the last 2 weeks have been a nightmare for me. I ended up in hospital 2 weeks ago on a stress-related thing. I was at 2 o'clock in the morning in the A&E and LGI. It's not a great place to be. Don't know if you've spent any time there. Interesting people. The psalmist reminds us, he says, and we all listen to this and don't do it, be still. And know that I am God. Or we say to each other, don't just sit there, do something. Or don't just sit there, pray something. Maybe we need to say instead, don't just do something, sit there. If I don't respond to this challenge, I'm not going to get to my 3 score and 10. I will not have run well, and I won't finish well. That's because although there's a certain amount of stress is good and healthy, the amount of stress that many of us experience is not. In fact, it's accelerating the rate at which our body degrades and eventually dies. Now, if we can manage stress, we can manage our lifetime strategically. So how do we do that? Well, the picture that Paul uses is this one of the jars of clay in verse 7. These are fragile, breakable, dirty things, which are not very attractive to look at, even when they're well presented. But what is inside them is a treasure. Very special. He's talking about this in the verses before that. The light of the knowledge of Jesus, what we've been worshipping about, singing about, shining in our lives and through us to others. That's the precious thing. And all the way through to Corinthians, this is one of the themes that Paul explores, that of, you know that thing about his power is made perfect in our weakness, power in weakness. Corinthians starts off by talking about God's comfort in our discomfort. Light and life against death and darkness. And here we've got the treasure in the earthen clay vessel. Paul does that here, paralleling that. He says, we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. We tend to cotton onto that pretty quick, don't we? That when the good things happen, then God gets his hand on us. It is him and it's not us. We're very aware of our inadequacies. So you ask the question, what is stress? And I think what it is when we take our lives outside of the jar. Or in our language, we'd talk about living out of the box or out of our boundaries. In other words, God has given us a shape to live in, a boundary, a box, a jar, a certain amount of time, energy, physical resource. And when we live beyond that, we experience stress. That stress should help us get back within our boundary, but if we persist in going outside, it then turns against us. Just like money. If we spend more than we have in the bank, we go into debt. I talked about this last week. Short-term debt, quickly repaid, needn't present a problem. Long-term debt will cause all sorts of problems. So I think, my guess is that most of you, all of you, will recognize what I'm talking about. What do we do about it? Well, in a few weeks' time, Alex and Karen will be speaking here, and they'll be going through some ideas about how to look after our bodies, how to take better care of ourselves physically. That's a really, really important part of running the race well. At the Vine, in a couple of weeks' time, at the grammar school, we'll be looking at play and that whole how we, you know, we talk about everybody gets to play, both participation and just the fun of play. So we're looking at that a bit. In the new season, after the summer, we're going to spend some time thinking about work-life balance and those issues. I want to comment quickly on some other steps we can take to personally address this issue and then discuss how we can reinforce that in a corporate way. The reason I'm flagging this is because I'm told by the medics that this is an increasingly common problem, so much so that they talk about it as an epidemic leading to widespread depression. And which means that many people in this room, knowing it or not, are suffering from a depression, part of which is triggered by stress. Now, it used to be that stress, depression was mainly from inherited illnesses, and that's still the case, but less so apparently, and it's sometimes triggered by circumstance of loss, bereavement, or loss of a job or something. But increasingly, it's now as a result of stress-filled lives. If Paul got depressed, it wouldn't have been through stress. When Elijah was depressed, in the Old Testament, it wasn't through stress. When we get depressed, it often is. In women, it frequently manifests itself in some form of anxiety, worry, and it's felt. You feel it and you're worried, and generally speaking, you'll talk about it. And that's how we've thought of depression. Actually, stress-related depression for men looks different, and so we haven't spotted it so well, so the medics tell me. What it looks like with men, it manifests itself usually in some form of substance abuse, over-drinking, other drugs, smoking, overwork perhaps, something like that. And it is not felt or spoken about, but is acted out. So the stressed husband comes home from work, slams the door, kicks the cat, watches the TV, won't talk to anybody, walks out again. That's the depressed husband. He's bouncing around, and he might go off to play rugby or something, so he might not look depressed in the way we've understood it, but that's what's happening. And it's a lot of it is because of that. It's our responsibility. So we choose lifestyles which take on too many commitments. We work too hard for long hours. Yes, I know, I'm speaking to myself. We overcommit in our finances and in our lifestyle expectations, so we have to pursue bigger, more demanding jobs. We associate busyness and hard work with success and affirmation, which is wrong. But the hard fact is that if we're living within God's boundaries for our lives, if we're living within our jars of clay, so to speak, we will have sufficient to do what needs to be done. That's a hard fact to realize, because it doesn't feel like that. But I don't believe God gives you this and expects you to do that. And if you're doing that and ending up stressed and eventually depressed, it's because we're not dealing with what he's given us to do. And the result of living our God-given lives, instead of being peace and fun, is full of anxiety and illness and fatigue and sorrow. So, you would very much like to be this, a giraffe. Do you know why? Because a giraffe only needs less than 2 hours sleep a day, apparently. You wouldn't want to be a python, which needs 18 hours of sleep a day. Okay. Now, if you only got 2 hours sleep a day, you might look like this. Choice. Archheart describes sleep as God's antidote for stress. So I've been doing a lot of research on this and reading up about it. There's a lot of conflicting information out there, but there's some things seem to be agreed upon, and I'll go through those very quickly. First of all, that there's a danger attached to lack of sleep. It's now a major. They tell me that it's a major cause of car accidents, road traffic accidents, and the major cause of workplace injury. So it's a big deal as far as the government are concerned. They're putting a lot of investment into trying to sort this because it's very dangerous. It seems that optimum sleep amount is between 7.5 and 9 hours. You can sleep longer than 9, but it doesn't tend to be associated with healthy lifestyle. Not many people can get by on less than 7.5. The definition is from Jim Horn, who's a Loughborough University Sleep Research Centre. He says, the amount of sleep we require is what we need not to be sleepy in the daytime. So those of you who are just nodding off, it's not me, it's you. You haven't had enough sleep. You should be able to wake up without an alarm. And if you wake up too early, you're not getting enough exercise because your body doesn't need the rest as much. If you get more exercise, it'll force you into a rest pattern. Interesting, eh? Sleep works in 1.5 hour cycles, 90-minute cycles for adults by and large. And within that 1.5 hour cycle, there are four-ish stages that we go through. And we need to complete each of those stages in order for it to work, that hour and a half cycle to work. Deep sleep, REM sleep, and all that, all those different bits. The bit with dreams at the end, as well as the bit with physical restoration at the beginning. And we're aiming for something like 5 or 6 1.5 hour cycles. So 5 of them would be 7.5 hours, 6 would be 9 hours, something like that. You know how sometimes when you wake up, you feel really, really groggy, and it takes you ages to get together. That's because you're in that part of the cycle which is very deep. Sometimes you wake up and you just pop up like that. That's because you've woken at the end of the hour and a half cycle, which is a natural waking point. And they tell me that you wake up actually each time the cycle finishes, but you immediately go back to sleep again. Try and sleep at the same time every night. Go to bed at the same time and wake up at the same time. Even at weekends. Apparently lions don't work. If your body knows that now's the time to sleep, now's the time to wake, it does a really good job of doing the bit in between of sleeping. Whereas if it's a little bit confused, it doesn't, apparently. Try and get your bedroom a nice place to sleep in. So remove distractions. I've had a bad time over the last couple of weeks. I'm learning this lesson with my mobile phone going off at city times in the morning. In the night. I won't mention any names, Elaine, about waking me up early with really exciting news. She's going red. I've got to sort that out because I use my mobile phone as my clock, but it's now people who text me in the middle of the night or ring me or whatever, sons and people. The TV, is that a distraction? Whatever it is, it should be a place that's comfortable, usually dark, quiet, that is good for sleeping in. Alcohol. In those cycles when you're sleeping, there are those points in each hour and a half cycle when you almost wake up or wake up and go back to sleep again. If you've one drink of alcohol is okay, but if you drink more than that, apparently, at that point where you wake up, the alcohol does something to your system, which means that you wake up completely. So that ends up with a disturbed sleep. And the same with caffeine. And things like that. And the same with exercise. So although exercise is good, it's best not to do it too near sleep because it gets your system working such a way that when you get to those light periods, you pop awake when you really should go back to sleep again. And then finally, what Jesus says about don't let the sun go down on your anger. Keep your conscience clear. It's difficult to sleep when you're worried about stuff and cross with people and not forgiving. Sleep and rest is difficult for me because there's so much I have to do. And so much I want to do, even if it's just reading a book. I find it very difficult to sit and not do anything. And that's partly because I'm an A-type, and I'm learning how my body must have sleep and rest if it's to function better. Let me give you an analogy of why that works. For those of you who are A-types like me, who are driven and overactive, this is me in the bath, except it's normally in our house, it's Alison in the bath, but that doesn't look like Alison. It could be Josh, with all the bubbles. And that is the immersion next to it. And immersion, I think, is like a big kettle. It's got that thing in the middle which heats up and heats the water and then pumps it around the house. For us, in the summer, when we turn off the central heating, we use that for our hot water, and it takes about 45 minutes to heat up a full tank. Once hot, we can get a full bath and maybe a shower or a bit more out of it. If we run a bath, and this person's run a bath, and they have a very quick one and jump out and then somebody else gets in and runs another bath, they'll find that they won't get a full hot water. The water will get cooler and cooler as you run off the hot water, obviously, and the heating filament can't heat it up as quickly as it's coming off. So you have to turn off the hot taps for a while. Now, you could say that when we're not running a hot tap, nothing useful is going on. People are getting dirty and we're not doing anything about it. But there is something going on. The heating element is heating up the water. Doesn't look nothing, you can't see anything. You're standing there getting dirtier and dirtier. But the water is heating up. And when time has passed, there will be plenty of hot water again. Similarly, when I just sit down and look at the tree, my body is saying, ah, great, let's do some restoration work. When I'm asleep, my mind is going through what happened the day before. The memory functions work out which bits of the things you experienced the day before you need to keep and which you can ditch. Those of you who know about computers know what a defrag is when you sort out your hard drive. That's what's going on in one of the bits of the hour and a half. It defrags your memory so that you remember the bits that need to be remembered and you can forget the rest. If we try to remember every experience and smell and sound and word and everything during the course of the day, we'd blow up after 2 days. So although you think you're not doing anything, actually lots is going on inside and it's very useful, and you can't have the bath the next day if you haven't had the immersion on. And in verse 16, Paul talks about this. He says, we do not lose heart, but outwardly we're wasting away, yet inwardly we're being renewed day by day. This is a call to look after ourselves. Yes, we've got to manage these physical bodies, which are wasting away, and we've got to manage that process with care and get to the 70 or whatever it is. Remember what I said about this power in weakness theme? What Paul is saying here is within our wasting physical shell, allow God to renew us within. Two things on that quickly. One is that this is not just like replacing. When it says renewal, it's not replacing a worn-out tire and putting back another one where the other one has worn out. This is something much more building towards the future. In the next verse, you remember, he talks about future eternal glory. So the point will come when we stand before God and, the earth is finished and we're standing before him in his glory and he's saying, welcome to heaven. Come in. Okay? The bit of us that goes in there and meets with him is being renewed and improved and worked on day by day by day. That's getting better and better and better. We talked about that last year. That transformation and growing up to be more like Jesus. And we're going to look at that is Jason here? Jason Proctor? He's teaching in a couple of weeks' time about that bit of us, our soul, restoring our soul. The other thing is that this is something that happens daily. There's a rhythm to it, the rhythm of recovery, the rhythm of restoration. It starts at the daily level and it works upwards to weekly and annual and other things. Sleep is part of that, and so is your devotional life. What Spurgeon calls the culture of the inner person. Now, although what we do here helps as the community of faith that is Wharfdale Vineyard, at the end of the day, you're responsible for your inner person, your life. God gives you what you need, and you should feed and care for this person every day. Now, okay, that's personally. Now, what about as a corporate, as a group of people, what do we do? When Alice and I and Josh and Sam first planted here, we used to talk about trying to have a church which doesn't have many meetings. We now find, a few years later, that we have a full diary and a program of things going on. On the one hand, that's brilliantly exciting. On the other hand, it's absolutely exhausting and perhaps distracting from our core vision and purpose. So I just want to rehearse very quickly some of the principles we're trying to operate to help manage that stress, to help you renew yourself, your inner person daily, and what we can do on that. So being part of this community of faith doesn't make your stress levels worse. That is not meant to be the point. First of all, there's a number of things here. There's the opt-out factor, which you've heard us talk about probably. We try and design our program and events around an invitation, not a three-line whip. You're free to opt in or opt out of anything. That means you can choose to sit at the back and read the newspaper, or you'd not come at all. Okay? If you're here, I'm assuming you choose to be here, and you want to be here, and you want whatever's going on. You may not feel like it, but you know it's the best thing for your inner person. I'm not saying you're here with a smile on your face, but you do, you know, it's like sometimes you have to go to the dentist. Now, of course, most of you are on the rotas to serve, and to that extent, you graciously forego your right to opt out that week in order that somebody else can have that turn. That's fine. And some of us find people time more or less replenishing. For some of you, a house group in the week and a meeting and maybe something on Saturday is enough, and you don't want to see anybody else on Sunday. You want to wash the car and watch the cricket. Others of you, you come to stuff like this because you love it. And it's over too quickly, and you're replenished and buzzing, and you love it. Okay, do what's appropriate for you. Secondly, it's about relationship, not attendance. So learning to follow Jesus is about a relationship with him. It's not about attendance at an event. I'm not going to measure where you are in your faith by how often you turn up at this or a house group, whatever. Those are all there to help, but that's not what it's about. It's about relationship with him. I'd encourage you to eat at home. I mean by this spiritually. So don't use what we do together as the place that you always get fed. You need to be full when you come. So you need to do sort your devotional life out and look after the inner person. We'll look at that a bit more in a few weeks' time. I want you to foster non-church relationships. If you get heavily involved in Wharfdale Vineyard and stop talking to your neighbor and to your workmate and to your family, you know, that's not a good thing. You need to foster those relationships. This is meant to help that, not draw you away from it. One of the most adamant commands in the Old Testament, repeated again and again with dire warnings, is the need for taking a day off. That may be a Sunday, and if Sunday is for you a truly restful day, that's great. It isn't for me. So our day off is Wednesday. And on a Wednesday, we turn off the... I don't look at my emails and stuff, and we tend to do non-church stuff. Find a way to have a day of rest. Work it out. I know it's not easy. I find it extremely difficult, but do it. It's a really, really important part of looking after yourself. And then finally, not a vacuum. And what I mean by that is that I sense slightly that if you choose, say, not to come to weekly worship or not to go to house group or just to stay at home, that you're in a vacuum, like that's a spiritual no man's land. Not at all. You're a follower of Jesus 24/7. You're part of, he's in your life all the time. So whether you're here or at home, you're still in a relationship with him and still about the kingdom, whether it's restoring yourself or talking to a friend or reading a book or worshiping here. It's not a vacuum out there and something here. Does that make sense? This is here to help. It's not replacement. And it doesn't mean that when you're not here, you're nowhere. So what this means is that as an organization, we want to reinforce the opt-out thing. So I do that by talking about the language I use is about inviting you to join in, giving you freedom not to do this. I said at the beginning of the worship, stand up to start with, but then sit down if you wish, da-da-da. We do the same with house groups. We try not to say, you know, where were you last week? We might want to know where they were, somebody is, because we care for them, but not because they need to be there because it's an attendance thing. Several of you have settled to a pattern. I think it's the Farnhills. They come on our first Sunday of the month. They do minicab on the third Sunday of the month, and I think they serve on one other Sunday. So they have a pattern that some of you will do things frequently and some infrequently. It's your call, whatever is best for your inner person. Our habit is to keep the fifth Sundays free. Now, this is a deliberate attempt to force some daylight into a crowded calendar. We avoid setting up formal Wharfdale events on these weekends. Of course, you can organize your own social and personal things, but preferably stuff that doesn't go on the website and stuff that doesn't get advertised. And we're doing this because we want to give our leaders and staff a sort of a forced day off, a weekend off. If we don't plan it in like that, it won't happen. It's also to help you plan your diary. Everybody knows when you just look at your calendar and you can see when the next four fifth Sundays are. Look ahead. And it gives you ability to plan away, your weekends away, visits to family, opportunities to catch up at home. Maybe you wash the car once a quarter and that would be a good time to do it. Again, it's not a vacuum. It doesn't mean to say everything stops and there isn't the vineyard on that fifth Sunday. It is. It's all over the place, but it's just not in the here. It's in your homes, in your friends. It's on weekends away in London. It's on holiday. Similarly, August for us has always been a tradition to keep that free of a formal program. Same sort of reasons, really. Numbers fall off of the summer, so it's harder to run events anyway. The leaders need a break to think and plan and consider the future. It provides a good opportunity for teams and house groups to stop and restart and rejig and things. So we encourage the house groups to take a break at that point. It does make September, when we all get back together again, usually for a barbecue in the first Sunday up at the grammar school, as a really big, great day when we all get back together again and say, hi, how was your summer? And it makes that a bit of a special. By all means, have parties and picnics and do things together. In fact, obviously, Ashburnham falls into that. But we're not going to be running formal Sunday events, and generally speaking, the house groups stop. They don't have to, but we're listening to do that. And then we reinforce this Sabbath thing of taking the days off, and Alice and I take Wednesday off, as you heard about Nikki, take Saturday off. Find out which day the staff take off and leave them alone on those days. And I encourage you to do the same. I'm whizzing now. What I'm saying is that although as we grow, there'll be lots of things going on, and often, increasingly, several things going on at once. Like today, we've got two things going on, Browning House and T for 12, and maybe some other things. You don't have to do them all, okay? Don't worry about that. Just find out what it is that it would be good for you to get involved in, what area of service would be good for you to commit to, and do that. Don't worry about the rest. It's not, you know, it's not a legal thing of having to be around. You're responsible for your jar of clay, and you're responsible for looking after your inner person, being renewed day by day. What helps you to do that the most? I'm sorry I went through that a little quick, but I'm running up to the end of my time. So I'm really concerned that we find out what it is that will keep us healthy and running a good race all the way through. Part of that is sleep. Sleep more. Part of that is, and for me, I'm now starting to finish meetings that I'm in charge of earlier and earlier. You know, I'm a night person, so I happily run a meeting through to midnight and I'm still going strong. But it's killing me at the other end. So I'm changing the way I do that, which is upsetting some people because I get up and walk out in the middle of a conversation. But I'm doing my best to learn that. We need to learn what it is to look after ourselves better and better. I'm trying to get more sleep. I have since I've been trying, I've not. It's got worse. But I'm trying. And I'm trying to change my expectations of my life so I'm reducing the stress levels. There's some very practical things I have to think about, financially, job-wise, and all that, to do that. I encourage you to do the same. Would you like to stand? We need to go and get the children shortly, but I just want to pray. The trouble with this room is it's very crowded, and I appreciate that it's a bit difficult to move around. I felt the Lord said there was a couple of groups of people here that you need to sort of respond to what I'm saying and talk to God about it. One is that it's like going into debt financially. You're not doing it financially. Maybe you were last week. But you're going into debt in life with your energy, with your emotional level, with sleep. And it's time, like you sort your finances out, it's time to sort that out. You know exactly who you are. Some of you specifically need some help in sorting out sleeping patterns. You may need professional help, go to see your doctor or whatever, but we want to pray for you as well. When I said that following Jesus is not about attendance, it's about relationship, that's news for some people. And if that's you, again, we'd love to pray for you and reaffirm that. And finally, it may be here that you've never decided to follow Jesus and you'd like to do that today. Again, we'd love to pray with you and talk you through that. So and there may be other things going on, so let me just pray. Lord, I ask you to come. I thank you for your presence here, and I thank you that your presence rests in jars of clay. It's an awesome and mind-boggling thing that you would choose to have your life in these frail bodies. And it's too big a thing for us really to grasp. But Lord, we say we're thankful, and will you help us look after them better? Lord, we're thankful, and will you renew us day by day? I pray for those who are struggling with the sleep thing, and I ask you to come and to just open, shine your light on this and open up opportunities for them to rejig their lives so that they can sort that out. I pray for those who, when I talked about being depressed, thought, well, actually, that sounds like me. And Lord, I ask you to heal them and put them back in the right place. Change us, Lord. Heal us. May we fall in love with you again and live lives which are full of bounce and energy and fun and balance. We're sorry when we get this wrong. So I'm sorry. And we are sorry. Many of us need to repent that we've got this wrong. Please forgive us and give us a new start, a new chance to do this.